I'm Steve Kraske, and this is KCUR's Up to Date. With so many issues and candidates to keep up with during the election, you may find yourself reaching for the panic button. But don't. KCUR has got you covered. Today, a pre-election political panel to help prepare you for Tuesday. Missouri voters will find the voting process a little longer than usual. We'll discuss the big ballot issues and one of the most watched Senate races in recent memory. We'll also cover three big races going on in Kansas, all of which seem to be coming down to the wire. And Jackson County voters will see seven questions near the bottom of their ballots. We'll find out what they mean. We'll get you up to date after this hour's news. Well, Election Day is Tuesday, and we're counting down the minutes, and today we're counting down the big races and the big issues. In our first segment today, we'll take a look at that big U.S. Senate race in Missouri and some of the key ballot initiatives that you'll be voting on. They include a vote to increase the minimum wage, another to clean up Missouri government, and yet another that would bring medical marijuana to the state for the first time. With us, Erica Hunzinger is with Harvest Public Media, and she's an editor here at KCUR. Erica, welcome back.
Thanks for having me, Steve.
Joe Manis covers politics for St. Louis Public Radio. Joe, it's always good to have you.
Hey, thanks for asking me, Steve. Thank you.
And your questions about the Missouri ballot are welcome at 816-235-2888. And just so you know, KCUR has a handy-dandy voter guide posted online at kcur.org that's designed to help voters navigate a lengthy and sometimes confusing ballots on Tuesday. Erica, you know, Senator Claire McCaskill is going after her opponent here in the closing days for Josh Hawley's use of political consultants in his attorney general's office. She's calling that inappropriate and potentially illegal. Is that charge a game changer here?
I don't know that you can call anything but a major misstep a game changer at this point in the
And this isn't that, it doesn't sound
Not yet. I mean, I think it's going to fire up people in her base, but not people who are on the fence. There's no charges being filed. And so basically, Hawley brought these folks in at the when he started in the AG's office, and they started kind of running this Senate campaign before he actually didn't say he was going to run until October. But really, according to Missouri law, these consultants and the state folks would have had to have been discussing the campaign on state time. Mm-hmm. For it to be illegal, Hawley said he's followed the rules and the staffers were paid for by his campaign fund and not the state. So I don't think it's quite the game changer.
Joe, do you agree with that?
Well, I think it's going to be complicated, and it may take a while to shake out. I mean, I was involved in the Bill Webster investigation as some other well, there aren't many reporters left.
I about, was too, Joe.
About 20, that, we're, that's what I was going to say.
We're dating ourselves here, aren't
yeah,
we?
Yeah, about 26, 27 years ago. And it started out simple, and it got really complicated as it went on. But this is Friday. The election's next Tuesday. The average voter, Erica, is correct. They're not focusing on the nuance of all this. And I thought after Wednesday's big rally here with Joe Biden, kind of boiled what the election should be about to three topics: health care, Social Security, Medicare.
Wow.
So the next day when McCaskill did this phone call, first she jumped on Hawley over the Kansas City Star's latest disclosure, and then she did kind of segue into it. But I think she's having trouble keeping focused on that because, frankly, from a tactical standpoint, I think in some ways Biden – just looking at it from a not issue oriented, but just what moves voters, he's probably got a better handle on it than maybe she does. She seems to be getting too distracted by some of the side stuff. And when you've got less than, I mean, you only got 5 days to go, she probably needs to take his advice. I mean, because Hawley definitely is taking the president's advice on what he's focusing on, and it's just a couple topics.
You know, you get a sense here, Erica, that while this race is close, that perhaps Josh Hawley has opened up a slight lead going into this final weekend. Several national pundits are calling this race for Hawley. Is it still too close to call? How do you see it?
I think it's too close to call. I mean, if you look at the New York Times, I think Real Clear Politics and 538, it's about within a 2% margin, and then Fox News has them tied. So, you know, at this point, I don't know that you can actually call it. And all these things that have been kind of launched against Hawley haven't seemed to be sticking.
I was going to say, let's talk about that for a moment, Joe, because Josh Hawley has gotten hammered in recent weeks with reports that his attorney general's office is in disarray, that outside political consultants influenced the way Hawley ran his department. He's wiped out his office's environmental division. And for these questions that remain over his investigation of former Governor Eric Greitens, that he wasn't tough enough on a member of his own party. You don't get the sense, as Erica just mentioned, that any of this stuff is sticking. I'm wondering why.
Well, part of it, I think, is because of timing. If this had happened maybe a month ago, where people would have more time to digest it, McCaskill would have time and her outside allies would have time to craft some TV ads slamming him on this, it might have an impact. But when most of this happens within the last 2 weeks, most of the ads have been produced. The ad time has been already bought. And the public also is being inundated with other stuff, like the ballot initiatives, which just now are starting to get a lot of attention. So the result is all of a sudden the Senate race is sharing the spotlight with stuff. I think also for some people it's a little too complicated. But, I mean, McCaskill got hammered for months on certain things, and I'm not going to replay him. And some of them were turned out to be not true, according to various outside nonpartisan fact checkers.
Right.
But still, she's still being hammered on that stuff, whether the fact checkers say it's accurate or not. And I think in her case, if some of the Hawley stuff had come out a month earlier, it might have stuck more. But I think now you got the president who was in yesterday, is coming back in on Monday. I think it all boils down at this point to the ground game. Now, allegedly, Democrats tell me that she'd invested a lot of her money into setting up a pretty expansive field operation in a lot of these counties and in St. Louis County. Well, the rubber's meeting the road, and that's what's going to determine this. I think as long as it's really close, it's going to be who can get their people to the polls, who can make sure these people go in and vote. Democrats always have a harder time doing that. Republicans don't need to be goosed as much, apparently. Mm-hmm. And so I think that's what's going to drive some of this in the next few days. It's going to be who gets their people out.
We're talking about what's on the Missouri ballot on Tuesday. I'm wondering, too, about what Josh Hawley's main criticism of Claire McCaskill has been and what's been her main criticism of him, Erica. How do you size that up?
Well, Hawley has been saying from the beginning, like back in March, that McCaskill's a liberal elite who doesn't pay attention to the needs of everyday Missourians. And that's, you know, what she's doing in Washington and on the campaign trail. McCaskill's really been hammering Hawley on the federal health care law. And as, you know, Joe noted, she kind of moved away from that messaging this week, you know, kind of stopped the pre-existing conditions to focus on these other stories that all came out. But beside the federal health care law, she's also really hammering that he's not keeping his promise from the attorney general's campaign in 2016 when he said that this office was not a stepping stone for him. And then within a year, less than a year, he was saying he was going to run.
You know, Joe, President Trump, I think you've mentioned, will be here not once. He was here last night, but, you know, twice here in the closing days for Josh Hawley. How much of a difference would that make? And, I mean, you wouldn't think he'd be coming here if he didn't think that Hawley might win, or am I wrong about that?
I think he wouldn't be coming here if he was sure Hawley was going to win. I think because he's got other places to go. He's coming here because he's concerned he might not, and maybe Trump's presence, Trump attracts these huge rallies, that might make the difference. Because if Hawley lacks a ground game within his campaign, and I've been hearing that for financial reasons, they don't have one that's nearly as extensive as McCaskill's, they need star power. They need like somebody like Trump who really brings in people, tells them you got to vote. Like Trump last night made a key point of saying, act like he's a point down. So Trump is there to rev them up. I was looking at a poll a few days ago, and the top numbers don't mean anything. What I was interested in was some of the crosstabs. Mm-hmm. And the interesting point was Okay, Democrats in Missouri, according to this poll, were 10 percentage points ahead as far as being energized. But, and that was like 78% to 68%. I mean, this is just on energy. But the next group of people in the middle, the Republicans, it was like 25% to like 15% for the Democrats. In other words, there are more Republicans who maybe are for Hawley but just aren't as enthused about all the stuff. That's what the Republicans and that's what the president are honing in on. In other words, the Republicans have moved to grow. The Democrats don't have as much move to grow. So all they can do is just make sure those people that are so enthused actually get out there. The Republicans got to get that middle group who are overwhelmingly for Hawley, presumably, to join the ones at the top and get out there and vote. And I think that's why the president was in Columbia, because he's hoping to reach a lot of the rural people in the middle part of the state, even though Columbia itself is not, but it's a center hub. And then Cape Girardeau, which is southeast Missouri, and that's crucial. If McCaskill gets, let's say, 30, 35% down there, she might manage to survive. If she gets less than 30, she's not.
Hmm. What do we know about, there's been some stories, Erica, in the media about Claire McCaskill struggling in this campaign to energize African-American voters on her behalf. Has that changed or is it still an issue for her?
Well, I have to say, to be honest, we haven't done much reporting around that here, although Emmanuel Cleaver did tell our reporter Samuel King that he is backing her. I know Joe's side of the state had a little bit more interesting stuff happening this week.
Yeah. Joe, what are you seeing over there on that front?
Yeah, I think there's been a real, okay, a year ago, you had some of the major African-American Democrats over here who were saying she needs to do more. They were whispering, you know, she's just not present enough. Okay, fast forward. The last couple weeks, big push. And you've got several prominent African-Americans. State Senator Jamila Nasheed's been all over the place. Lacey Clay has endorsed her and is helping somewhat. But one of the smartest things she did, I think, just tactically, is that she got Wesley Bell, who is the Democratic nominee for St. Louis County prosecutor. He knocked off Bob McCullough in a huge, shocking upset just 3 months ago. Well, Bell is young, he's dynamic, he has a lot of buzz behind him. Who was featured at the Biden event Wednesday night? Wesley Bell.
Hmm.
I mean, there was another candidate as well, but the point was the crowd went crazy for him. He, you know, went on about how great she was, this, that, and the other. He's done some, I think, some digital spots for her. It's that kind of thing that was probably shrewd on her part. Now, whether or not it's enough at the end to help, but it sure doesn't hurt. And I had been told a month ago by about several African-American Democrats who had told me privately that she was showing up in churches, doing a lot of stuff under the radar to really kind of get people excited. And they thought she had a chance of pulling it off. But again, we'll see what happens right on Tuesday.
Okay, let's turn to some of the issues on the Missouri ballot next week. There's a proposal to gradually raise the minimum wage to $12 an hour over several years. Labor supports this message, this measure. Chambers of Commerce do not. How has this campaign been waged here, Erica?
At least in the Kansas City area, there's been a lot of door-to-door campaigning and mailers. Just important to note that Kansas City last year approved a $15 minimum wage, and it was the legislature stepped in and told them they couldn't enact it. Same thing happened in St. Louis, although I think theirs was a little bit lower than that. So essentially, there was a state law that said it gets raised for everyone in the state or it gets raised for no one.
Yeah.
So I think people are a little motivated by that.
What about this Clean Missouri initiative, Joe, that takes multiple steps to clean up state government? Just a reminder here, Joe, what does this thing do? Because it does a number of things.
It does a lot of stuff. among other things, it puts some more restrictions on lobbyist gifts, makes it more difficult for legislators to turn around and become lobbyists. It's got some of that in there. But then the big kahuna in it is this whole provision that would set up a new system for drawing up state legislative districts. And
this is a big deal, right?
Yes, this is a big deal. Now, I want to make clear, the districts now are not drawn by the legislature. It's a committee that's set up by the governor, equal number from each party. If they don't come up with something that they can agree on, it goes to judges. But for various reasons, many people on both sides have said it's still been too political. Whoever's in power has a little edge. But the bottom line is this would set up something different. Well, and there would have it would have the state auditor set up, I mean, look at three contenders that the legislative leaders would pick to be basically a demographer in chief, in effect. And then it sets up this other system to draw up the districts. Now, because of some of the wording, some African-American politicians on this side of the state, in particular, have joined with some Republican legislators and officials who have not been keen on this to oppose it. So you've got Congressman Lacey Clay on this side of the state who is not in favor of it. And in fact, it's been an interesting dance because you've got McCaskill, for example, who does support the Clean Missouri thing, has kind of played it down because she doesn't want to get in a big fight, public fight with Lacey Clay over something. So now you've got prominent people on both sides going on about this, but I'm not sure that that fight is really getting through to voters. Mm-hmm. I think they're seeing the simple stuff. The Clean Missouri campaign has been really shrewd with their mailers and some of the promotions they've been putting out there. So again, we're going to see what happens on Tuesday. But so far, I would say they probably have, I mean, all the polls have shown them with an edge. And that's because those who are against it haven't had a unified, simple message that they can get voters to listen to.
You know, I'm wondering if all these initiatives, Erica, minimum wage, Clean Missouri, there's others on the ballot as well, medical marijuana. Do they wind up favoring one party or the other in terms of, you know, motivating voters to turn out and actually cast a ballot?
I would say you would probably see medical marijuana, minimum wage, Clean Missouri, all kind of leaning Democrat there.
You would think so.
I would think so. The gas tax that's on, the raising the gas tax, that has pretty broad support from Republicans.
Right.
But yeah, I would say that these in particular are somewhat Democrat heavy.
And there are also, Joe, these three medical marijuana ballot issues out there that are proving so confusing to voters for good reason, because
right.
They all do sort of the same thing. How are voters going to sort all that out? And how would you shorthand this for them?
Well, I'm not very good at shorthand.
Yeah.
But I'll be upfront about that. I just had a big feature that laid out some of this stuff this morning. But the bottom line is this. Amendment 2 has most of the money, most of the backing. Amendment 2 sets up a system that the state would run. I'm simplifying it, but the state, in effect, would run. They would license the growers. They would license the dispensaries. Doctors would have to authorize somebody, a patient, saying, yeah, this person has one of the diseases that would qualify that they could get this medicinal marijuana or the products, because there's various products. Mm-hmm. In fact, Eric and I were involved in a feature about this a little over a year ago.
Last year, yeah.
So now Amendment 3 is a whole different thing. It's a physician, lawyer, Brad Bradshaw from Springfield, got this on the ballot. It basically has a higher tax. It would use most of the money from authorizing the sale and of medicinal marijuana to pay for a cancer center that he says would be better than what already exists in St. Louis, Columbia, and Kansas City.
And that tax is like the highest in the country, one of the highest in the country.
Yeah, 15% compared to 4% for Amendment 2. Now, he says his tax is charged differently, but the bottom line, it's definitely a bigger tax. Now, he also has it would allow dispensaries, but they would have to be certified. It sets up this board. There really is virtually no state control over it, which is what the Amendment 2 people say. It's basically Brad Bradshaw, king of marijuana. And then then you've got this third one, which is a Proposition C, which is similar in some ways to Amendment 2. In fact, both of those groups are kind of allies. Some of the backers of Prop C say the reason they got on the ballot was that they were afraid that the group that was behind Amendment 2 wouldn't get enough signatures, and so they wanted to make sure there was something on there. The proposition has only a 2% tax. It has some of the same provisions. It doles out the profits a little differently to a variety of different groups,
right.
Whereas Amendment 2, any profits end up going to veterans groups. But the bottom line is those two aren't fighting so much. There's a lot of legal debate over what happens if who wins. Is there enough votes? The general consensus I've gotten from the former Supreme Court Judge Mike Wolf is that whichever one of the amendments gets the most votes is the one that will go into effect.
And one thing maybe to keep in mind here, Erica, is this notion that two of these three initiatives are constitutional amendments. One is a state law change.
Correct.
And some folks look at this and think, well, hey, if you pass just a state law, the legislature could get in and change it.
They can do what they
it's
want.
It's tougher to change a constitutional
Correct.
Amendment. And so that might be something to think about
Correct.
Here for voters.
They could change the qualifying conditions, even though with Prop C, it's 9 certain conditions that you can be not prescribed, but suggested that you can use marijuana for, plus a doctor's approval. So they could do that. They could change the tax. They could change where that goes. It's a little bit less, protected.
You know, the lines on Election Day could be long, given all these issues we're talking about here. And I'm wondering what effect that might have, Joe, as you look at what happens on Election Day.
Well, in St. Louis County, election officials have already announced that this will be the longest ballot in history in St. Louis County, because
wow.
there's other stuff on it too, without boring with the details. So they're estimating it's going to take 20, 25 minutes for
mm-hmm.
somebody to go through it.
They're saying the same thing over here.
Yeah, so they've been sending out sample ballots to people and reminding people that the stuff's going to be on both pages and make sure they reserve enough time. So you wonder if that doesn't scare away some people. Because they're like, I don't have time for this. Or maybe they're disabled and they're like, are there going to be enough accommodations for me to go through all this? If young people are going to be like, I don't have time for this. So I'm wondering how much the long ballot might actually deter people
right.
from voting, because they're like, I don't want to spend all this time.
Well, the AP did say this week, they reported that the voter turnout in the state is supposed to be 55%. That would be the highest since the 94 gubernatorial election. So not only do you have long ballots, but you also expect a giant turnout. So that's going to lead to a lot of long lines.
Well, that's really interesting.
Yes.
Why don't we have advanced voting in Missouri, Joe? I mean, so many states have it now. What's the holdup here?
Okay, I don't want to sound political, but in effect, what's happened is Republicans have blocked it for years because they believe it helps Democrats. I mean, to be very simple, that's the bottom line. Even though there's been some studies that say actually it helps both sides similarly, it's kind of similar to the action that the Republicans took in 2006 when they got rid of straight ticket voting in the state because they thought that helped Democrats. Although I always thought in 2010 they were probably kicking themselves because that was a big Republican year and they might have done better in 2010 and 2012 if they'd had straight ticket voting. But my point is, it's kind of that mindset, the belief that, well, we might be giving the other guy an advantage. So they haven't done it. There's been pushes by Secretary of States in the state from both parties over the years to try to get some sort of early voting, or at least make absentee voting easier and make it no fault absentee instead of where you have to check off one of these reasons. And if you don't check off one of those reasons, technically you're violating the law. So I think that eventually we may go to it, but we may end up being like the 49th or 50th state.
It's true.
Okay, we're going to leave our conversation there. Be forewarned, folks. Show up early to vote. Do your homework ahead of time. That might help the process move more quickly on Missouri. I want to thank Erica Hunzinger with Harvest Public Media. Joe Manis covers politics for St. Louis Public Radio. Thanks to you both for a very good primer. I sure appreciate it.
Thanks very much.
Yeah, thanks.
Time for a break. When we come back, we'll switch state lines and sides here and go over to Kansas and talk about the ballot there and what folks might expect. I'm Steve Kraske, and you're listening to Up to Date on 89.3 KCUR. And we're back. I'm Steve Kraske. Yesterday in the show, Democratic Kansas gubernatorial candidate Laura Kelly said bipartisan is the only way she knows how to work. Here, and the changes she wants to make for the state at kcur.org/uptodate. On Monday, we'll be asking you what candidate or issue will have you going to the polls on Election Day while you're voting in the midterm. That's Monday on KCUR's Up to Date. Okay, now we'll flip to the Kansas side of the state line, and we'll talk about the races for governor and Congress that have captured so much attention this year. We'll also run down the changes proposed for Jackson County government. With me now, Jim McLean is a Kansas News Service reporter and editor. Jim, always good to have you here.
Yeah, good morning, Steve.
Sam Zeff is a KCUR reporter. Sam, good morning to you.
Good morning, Steve.
Okay, Jim, we're just a few days away from the election. What do we know now about where the governor's race stands today? It's such an important election. Two candidates who would take the state in very different directions here.
You're saying, what do we know?
What do we know? Yeah, about where the race stands.
Yeah, well, we know it's really close, Steve. Of course, it's been close throughout. And the latest poll that I saw had Kelly up by 2 points, 43% to 41%. Ormond's still polling in the 10% range. But some very interesting things in that poll, too. 55% of respondents said they thought the state was heading in the wrong direction. In addition, 47% of Democrats polled said that they were really excited about the upcoming midterms. And only 34% of Republicans. It may show a little bit of a lack of enthusiasm for Republicans. That was a brutal primary. Chris Kobach, the Secretary of State, edged Jeff Collier. And you hear a lot of people saying that had Collier won that primary, this race might not be all that close.
Yeah, you do hear that. Sam, what's your sense?
I think that it is going to be exceptionally close. I do have one observation. Ormond continues to poll at about 9%. I think on election night we're going to see that shrink a little bit.
Yeah,
I think
that
people are going to get into the booth. They're going to have a come to whatever you come to moment, and I think either pull the lever for either Kobach or Laura Kelly. But I think by the end of election night, I think we're going to see Ormond with maybe 6 or 7% of the vote.
Well, and this comes in the wake of a devastating news story this week that Ormond's own campaign treasurer abandoned ship and is now endorsing Laura Kelly. This is a former Republican state senator from Johnson County. His name is Tim Owen. That's a shot across the bow to someone like Greg Ormond. That hurts a little bit, doesn't it?
Well, I think it's going to leave a bruise. There's no doubt about that. Tim is a longtime moderate, grew up in Johnson County, was on the Overland Park City Commission, longtime regular Republican in that part of the county. So for him to abandon Ormond at this point is going to leave a bruise. Did it happen early enough where people may decide that they're going to go for Kelly? I don't know about that, but it's got to sting.
Really interesting, Steve. When I talked to him the other day, he was one of the moderates that was essentially ousted from the Senate in 2012 when Brownback and the state chamber went after that group of moderates.
Right.
When I talked to him the other day, he said that Ormond gathered his really close inner circle supporters around sometime in September and said, I don't want to be a spoiler. So I'm going to reassess in early October. And if it doesn't look like I can win, I do not want to be a spoiler. He didn't promise to get out of the race or stop campaigning, but he made it clear to his supporters that he didn't want to play that spoiler role. And so when I talked to Owens the other day, he said that they really fully expected him to do something at that time, and he couldn't bring himself to stop campaigning, which again is one of the reasons I think that Owens jumped ship. Now, as to what you and Sam were talking about what voters may or may not do when they get into the booth, political scientists will tell you they call that strategic voting. Political scientists will tell you that voters don't do that very much.
Mm-hmm. Okay. Sam, no question, this is one humdinger of an election, this race for governor. The state goes one way if Chris Kobach gets elected, the other if Laura Kelly does. I mean, the contrast here could hardly be greater.
Oh, it's. I think it's black and white. I think that everybody is on pins and needles. I think educators in Kansas are particularly worried. When you see social media, you see a lot of education organizations out there working both on the ground for Laura Kelly, but also in the digital world. I think that there's it has some national implications. Certainly, Chris Kobach has a national reputation. I think it's the Kansas election has become even more forefront with all of the issues in Dodge City. I think that you're going to have a lot of political operatives looking at Kansas that night to see not only what happens with the gubernatorial race, but two really close and significant House of Representative races.
We're talking about the Kansas side of the state line, the election there next week, and some of the big candidates and the big issues. Is there one big issue in the governor's race, Jim?
You know, I don't want this to sound in any way slanted, but I think the big issue is Kris Kobach, mm-hmm. to be honest with you. I mean, mm-hmm. he has such a big personality. He is a firebrand conservative. You know, he's very proud of the fact he calls himself a consistent conservative, and he doesn't apologize. He's a little bit like Donald Trump, President Trump, in that way, in the sense that he will assert a point of view and he will stick to it no
yes,
matter what.
That's right.
And so I think the big issue is Kris Kobach, and then I think the shadow of Sam Brownback is still hanging over the state because Laura Kelly, one of her strategies has simply been to say that Kris Kobach would be like Sam Brownback on steroids because, of course, Mr. Kobach has said that he wants to go back to the tax cuts. Mm-hmm. He says Brownback's mistake was not cutting spending before he cut taxes. He says he won't make that mistake. He will cut spending and then cut taxes again. So I think that is the really big issue in this race.
Let's talk about another big issue in the arguments each candidate is making about the other. Kobach, Sam, says Laura Kelly is like Bernie Sanders, and she'll tax the state half to death. Truth check that for me. Does he have a point there?
I don't think that she's like Bernie Sanders. I think she's very much a Democrat, but not in the Bernie Sanders mold. She clearly doesn't like the Brownback tax cuts. She continues, by the way, to call it the Brownback experiment.
Mm-hmm.
So they must have tested that language because you hear her say that all the time. But I don't think it would be necessarily fair to say that she's a raging liberal, but she certainly is, I think, left of center a little bit.
Well, you know, when I'll get a little plug in here, Steve. We did an interview with her, and we have the final episode of My Fellow Kansans, the podcast,
right.
Coming out. It's about Laura Kelly, and she says that she was unaffiliated for most of her life, became a registered Democrat only in the early 90s. So I think she's a Kansas Democrat in the mold of Kathleen Sebelius, John Carlin, Bob Docking, et cetera. Very careful, very political. As you may remember, she got in trouble in the primary for not being liberal enough on mm-hmm. issues like gun control,
mm-hmm.
right? So she is no wild-eyed liberal. However, I was teasing her the other day that when Kansans walk into the voting booth, they would probably expect to see the name Liberal Laura Kelly on the ballot because every TV ad calls her Liberal
yeah.
Laura Kelly.
Oh, so when Kelly says that, to your point, Jim, that Kobach would be the equivalent of the third term mm-hmm. of Sam Brownback, does she have a point? Is that a fair argument?
Well, Jim made he's exactly right. That it would the point is that it appears that he would be Brownback on a rocket sled.
Mm-hmm.
Not only would they would go back to the tax cuts, but that he would have to find to make it work, take a meat axe to a budget, and that that includes education, roads, healthcare issues that I think dogged Brownback and conservatives in the legislature. So yes, I think she does have a point, and Jim's absolutely right about that.
You know, Jim, a group of prominent Republicans has endorsed Laura Kelly in this race. It's a big group now.
Right.
Why haven't we seen a comparable group of Democrats endorsing Kobach?
Well, I think the answer to that is fairly obvious. I mean, the Republicans who have been endorsing Kelly are very much moderate Republicans. I mean, former Governor Bill Graves, Mike Hayden, former U.S. Senator Sheila Fromm, and Nancy Kassebaum. And clearly what they're trying to do is to send a signal to moderate Republicans across the state to vote for Kelly over both Kobach and Orman. But Kobach, when I talked to him the other day, he thinks some of his positions, frankly, he's very much for more government transparency. For instance, he wants to make sure that every vote cast in the state house, whether it be at the committee on the floor and the committee of the whole, he wants them all to be recorded. He doesn't. And
mm-hmm.
so that's kind of a progressive position. And he also, frankly, has been fighting to reform the state's workers' comp laws. I think he thinks that he should probably get some Democratic support. But I think the fact that he wants to cut state state spending to the extent that he says he wants to do, and he wants to go back and revisit the tax cuts, I think that pretty much precludes any Democrat stepping up and saying, I'm for Kris Kobach.
Okay, if you're just joining us, you're listening to Up to Date on KCUR, and we're talking with two great reporters about the Kansas elections next week, Jim McLean with the Kansas News Service, Sam Zeff, a KCUR reporter. We're talking about all the issues, all the candidates, the big ones on the ballot next week in Kansas. If you want to join our conversation, 816-235-2888, or you can tweet us at KCUR Up to Date. Let's move over to the state's second district, the congressional seats here, because, gentlemen, as we sit here on this Friday, there's this unusual prospect out on the horizon that two of the state's four congressional seats might, and I underline the word might, could go Democratic. And we haven't seen that in the state for a number of years. Let's begin with the state's second congressional district. This is the one that includes Topeka, and it wraps down into southeast Kansas. Several news stories now have emerged about Republican Steve Watkins that raise all manner of questions about who he is and what he says about himself. That includes accusations that he's inflated his resume. Sam, what can you tell us about that?
I think there's been outstanding reporting on the part of the Kansas City Star on that. You know, Steve Watkins was a mystery. He came from nowhere.
He's a newcomer here.
Yeah. And I don't think anybody knew that much about him. He put his own biography out there. And as time wore on, as will happen, reporters checked into his background. Turned out that there were some holes in it. But I've seen parts of the debate with Paul Davis, the Democratic candidate, and I have to say that I come away thinking, well, this whole thing is this whole race is a little odd. It's a little weird. I can't quite wrap my arms around it. Watkins was vilified by his fellow Republicans in the primary.
Yeah, harshly so. Actually,
right.
The rhetoric was rough.
And now to how they've coalesced behind him, I have to say, I was a little surprised by that. But I believe that the National Republican Party, I think they look at this as a firewall. If they lose the Kansas second, I think it's a really bad night for the Republicans. And they've poured an enormous amount of money, $12, $13 million in this race combined. And that's in a district with really tiny media markets. The amount of time you can buy in Topeka and the Pittsburgh Joplin market, a little bit in Kansas City, is huge. I don't know how they have room for any other spots in both of those markets with that kind of political buy.
And yet, Jim, the race, at least based on the polls, it remains intensely competitive.
It does. I mean, it's within the margin of error. I mean, the last poll that I saw had Davis up by 4 points, but the margin of error was, beyond that, 4.9%, something like that. So it's been close throughout. I think everybody starting out when they saw this race, and Paul Davis, of course, is a former minority leader in the Kansas House. He ran for governor in 2014, came pretty close to upsetting Sam Brownback in that race. So he's a known quantity, a veteran political figure. And I think he's raised a lot of money. And of course, Steve Watkins, most of the money that fueled his early campaign came from a PAC that his father, a Topeka physician, created. So I think everybody starting out thought this is kind of Paul Davis's race to lose, notwithstanding the demographics of the district, of course, because it's a district that went pretty heavily for President Trump, unlike the third, which went narrowly for Hillary Clinton. Nevertheless, Watkins has, he won the primary with 26% of the vote, Steve, a bruising primary, as you pointed out. And Sam says, yes, the Republicans who were pretty harsh with him in the primary have coalesced behind him. But I detect a lack of enthusiasm on their part. You hear people say, like, yeah, we'll elect Steve because he's a Republican. We want to hold the seat, and we'll see how he does for 2 years. And if we need to replace him, we will. And that's, you hear some Republicans using language like that. And yet, you're right. It's a very close race coming down to Election Day. Most polls have shown Davis with a very slight lead. But again, all of those are within the margin of error.
And the issues in the race are just each other, or there are real issues that are getting talked about here?
It feels to me, from just watching it and reading about it, that it is more nationalized than some other congressional races. I think that, you know, and the Republicans have dragged back up the same charges, the strip club charge, other charges against Paul Davis that was used against him in the gubernatorial race.
Mm-hmm.
But it does feel to me that it is, with all the money coming in from the DCCC, from the Paul Ryan PAC, the Congressional Leadership mm-hmm. Fund, that this is really an example of a nationalized congressional race.
Okay.
Yeah, but I should say, though, that Watkins has gone after Davis for saying he's a Pelosi liberal, although Paul Davis has run a classic moderate Democrat campaign. He insists he will not support Nancy Pelosi for speaker. And he says, you know, he's in favor of – he says things like he is in favor of ICE and things. So it has been nationalized, but there have been some other issues, too, because Steve Watkins has called for privatizing and means-testing Social Security.
Mm-hmm.
And Davis has gone after him on that. And like a lot of Republicans across the country, Watkins has said he wants to repeal Obamacare, but he wants to preserve protections for pre-existing conditions. Davis says, of course, you can't have it both ways. But that's a strategy right. being used by a lot of Republicans because that health care issue is polling so well.
Well, let's segue over to the 3rd District in Johnson and Wyandotte counties here. Sharice Davids against Kevin Yoder. Sharice Davids was just here the other day saying she, too, would not support Nancy Pelosi. She wants new leadership in the U.S. House of Representatives should the Democrats take control here. What has this race turned on here, Sam?
I think that it has turned on a little fatigue with the incumbent Kevin Yoder. And I think that Sharice David's personal story has really resonated. You don't see her out at doing a lot of speaking. She doesn't do a lot of interviews with reporters. They've done one debate. That was the one that was on Facebook Live
right.
a couple of days ago. But I think that I've seen her a number of times in small group interactions. I think she does a lot of door knocking. And I think that her personal story really resonates, right? Started at Johnson County Community College, works her way up to go to Cornell Law, a fellow in the White House when President Obama was there, LGBT, Native American.
Right.
I think that personal story has really propelled her forward, and she leans on that, right? In the debate, I can't tell you how many times, I stopped counting how many times she said, I was raised by a single mom. My mom was a drill instructor in the Army. So she really, really leans heavily on that, and I think it caught fire in the 3rd District.
You know, Kevin Yoder, though, the incumbent Republican, says she's way too new. She hasn't only voted in the district a couple of times over the years, doesn't know the 3rd District. That's been his comeback here.
Right. And that is true. But if you're going to say that about Sharice Davis, you also have to say that about Steve Watkins. They're both brand new candidates with clear ties to Kansas, right? I mean, they clearly have ties here, although they've gone and had careers somewhere else, but then they came home. But Yoder's right. I mean, he is a lifelong he grew up outside of Johnson County, but most of his adult life has been spent here as a lawyer in the state legislature, now in Congress. So that is true. But to say that she doesn't have ties to Kansas is just not right.
If the race does go to Davids, and again, the sentiment among insiders is she seems to have a lead here at this point, and the district went for Hillary Clinton in 2016 over Trump. Could you make an argument the 3rd District is starting to turn a little bit, going from its traditional Republican roots maybe to something more moderate or even Democratic?
I don't think it's a Republican and Democratic issue. I think it's a conservative versus moderate issue. This is a district that's always been pretty moderate, sent Dennis Moore to Congress numerous times. He was a Democrat, a moderate, middle-of-the-road Democrat. So I think that the roots of this district are not so much whether you're an R or a D, but how you see yourself politically. And I think it's a very educated, middle-of-the-road district.
Right.
So I think that it's not necessarily returning to its roots. I don't think that it's necessarily changing very much, but it is acting as it has acted historically over the last few
Democratic
decades.
Registration is picking up in Johnson County, though.
Yeah. We should let our listeners know when they can cast their ballots. Advance voting has already started in Kansas, and polling places will be open there from 7 to 7 on Election Day. As we mentioned in the first segment, Missouri voters don't have the option to vote early. Polling places in that state will open at 6 and close at 7 in the evening. That's your instructions for Tuesday. Sam Zeff, let's just go quickly over to the Jackson County, the series of ballot questions that Jackson County voters will be asked to render judgment on. This is really lengthening the ballot in Jackson County and probably adding a lot of time for some voters to get through the ballot. A lot of this is a big, all about an anti-Frank White push here, taking power away from the county executive. Tell us about it.
Yeah, it is all, it is completely about opposing Frank White and his leadership as executive in Jackson County. There are 7 ballot questions. They are going to be at the end of the ballot. So you're going to start with McCaskill, the Senate race, and then work down to that. The only the last thing on the ballot is going to be the library, Kansas City, Missouri library question. Mm-hmm. But the 7 questions that take into consideration everything from ethics to pay raises to term limits, whether or not the sheriff should take over the Jackson County Jail.
Right.
This is probably the best example of an anti-Frank White of an anti-Frank White issue. So there is an organized opposition. They've raised a little money, about $32,000. Most of that, $25,000, from the campaign committee of Frank White. You can see that story up on KCUR.org right now. There's usually, by the time you get to that part of the ballot, political operatives will say that you've lost anywhere from 20% to 30% of the people who've gone into the booth.
Well, it's tricky here because one of the ballot questions, I think the first one says, "Hey, do you favor term limits for Jackson County legislators?" A lot of these legislators in Jackson County have been around for 20 or 30 years.
Right.
But if you want to vote for that, you've also got to take a pay raise for county legislators, and you get the yin and the yang there, at least for some voters.
Yeah, it's the same with all the elected officials, right? So if you want to term limit the executive or you want to term limit the sheriff, you also have to give them more money. I also do want to mention here the odd way that Jackson County does pensions for elected officials. So anybody who leaves now, if these pay raises are approved by the voters, by the time they retire, they don't retire based on their own salary. They retire based on the salary of the incumbent at the time.
Hmm.
So if you're going to retire in 10 years and take your Jackson County pension and your Gene Peters Baker or Daryl Forte, if he wins, your pension is going to be based on a salary 10 or 15 years down the road, which is a very odd way to do pensions.
That's KCUR. Sam Zeff running it all down for us. Jim McLean with the Kansas News Service based here at KCUR. Guys, you always do a great job. Thanks so much for coming in. Sure appreciate it.
Yeah. My pleasure.
Monday on the show, we'll ask, what's your motivation for voting in the midterm election? Our theme music is composed by the great Bobby Watson. We had help this week from Coy Duggar, Steven Steigman, Danny Alexander, Luke Martin, Emily Reed, and Devin Davis. Have a great weekend, all. I'm Steve Kraske, and you are up to date.